This will be for the first session, Business for the Glory of God. And in the second session, I want to talk about business ethics. And just as a kind of a preparation for that, if you, during the morning, think of some ethical question that you face in the workplace, jot a note down about it, what it is, and see if we can interact over it sometime during the morning. I was trying to think of a whole lot of examples of ethical challenges, and I have a few, but I'll need your help with thinking of some more real-life examples from people who are really working in the middle of the workplace just this week and next week. Did we pray? You know, I sometimes even say that when I already said grace for a meal, and then I say, so I wasn't sure. Let's pray. Our Father, we give you thanks and praise. We thank you for the joy of being able to be in your presence, gather with your people, look at your word. We thank you for the remarkable way in which you've created us with so many abilities that surpass those of the entire animal kingdom and even those of the angelic realm, ways in which we can glorify you and represent you and serve you. And so we ask that you would guide us and be with our discussions and help us to learn from your word this morning. Amen. Well, I was on my way out here and on the flight from I changed planes in Dallas, and on the Dallas to BWI flight, was sitting next to a man, got talking to him, and he owns a business in California that installs skylights in buildings. And I said, well, oh, you know, I've written a book on the moral goodness of business. And before I said that, it was like he was apologizing for being in the business world. I mean, just the tone of voice and the, you know, because it's so common that I encounter people who think that being in business is just being greedy and cheating people and ripping people off. And maybe he wasn't feeling that, maybe I was assuming that. But when I said I wrote a book on the moral goodness of business, he said, oh, I would be interested in that. So that's what I want to talk about for this first session this morning. I have a list of topics here under point A, topics related to business: ownership, productivity, that is making things or service, making goods from the earth or making them better, or producing services too. Employment, that is hiring someone or working for someone. Commercial transactions means just buying and selling. Profit, I think that's a morally good thing. Money, inequality of possessions, competition, borrowing and lending, and then a little bit of comment on attitudes of heart and effect on world poverty. What I want to say about items 1 to 9 is that they are not morally evil, but necessary. And they're not morally neutral, but I think they are in themselves morally good in God's sight. But they can all be used in wrong ways and in sinful ways. But they start out as morally good. Just one preliminary comment on those things before we get to the details. That is point B, glorifying God by imitation of his attributes. I'm going to come back to that more than once this morning. Ephesians 5:1 says, be imitators of God as beloved children. And if you think of God as creator, and then he created the earth, and he put human beings on it, he put us on it to reflect his character. So, you shall be holy as I am holy. He wants us to be like him. Or walk in love as Christ loved us. There's imitation. Or we love because he first loved us. Be merciful as your heavenly Father is merciful. There are quite a few commands that be holy for I am holy, that reflect the fact that we are to be like God. And he takes delight in that because he delights in his own moral character, and he likes to see it imitated in the creatures that he has made. He takes pleasure in that. And so now point C, how should we evaluate these attributes, these aspects, rather, of business activity? So let's think about them. First, owning possessions is fundamentally good and provides many opportunities for glorifying God, but also many temptations to sin. If you think back in the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20, we have Exodus 20:15, you shall not steal. And then down in the Tenth Commandment, there's a little expansion of the intent of all of them. It tells that our heart attitudes have to be right as well. So not only shall you not steal, but verse 17, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. And then, or a little later, or his ox or his donkey or anything that is your neighbor's. So why should I not covet Mark's new car? I don't know if you have a new car or not. Why should I not covet Mark's new car if Mark lives next to me? Because it belongs to him. And why should I not steal it? It belongs to him, not to me. That command, you shall not steal, assumes ownership of property. It assumes that that doesn't belong to the community. It belongs to Mark. Right? And I shouldn't steal his ox or his donkey or his Toyota because it's his. And the division of the land in Israel, when it was divided among the tribes, it went to different families who had family land that that belonged to them, didn't belong to somebody else. And people weren't supposed to steal their neighbor's land, but by moving a landmark or something, and they weren't supposed to covet their neighbor's house as well. Now that commandment then puts the Bible in direct contradiction to the heart of communist theory. Karl Marx himself said, the theory of the communists may be summed up in one sentence, abolition of private property. I think that's a horribly dehumanizing system, because if you don't own property, you don't have the moral choices available to you to decide how to use the property and use it in ways that are glorifying to God, for instance. And it's directly contrary to the assumption of ownership of property that is found right in the Ten Commandments. I think God put a system of ownership of property in the moral code that he established in the Bible, because it is another aspect of imitating God. So God is sovereign over the entire universe. He governs it. And he lets us be sovereign or govern over little aspects of it. Whether it's a four-year-old child who is taking care of her own toys or taking care of a pet, or whether it's a 40-year-old factory manager who is responsible for 1,000 employees, there's a reflection of sovereignty that is wise care and management of something that is entrusted to you. Does that make sense? So the desire to own things isn't wrong in itself. It's a God-given attribute. It's part of how we imitate His sovereignty. And then when we do own things, we take care of them. Mark washes his car, changes the oil, puts air in the tires. There's wisdom involved with that. And we can care for others with the property that's been entrusted to us. We can care for families and children that we raise. We can give to others, and we can invest and and make the property be more productive. But in all of that, God is, I think, allowing us to bring to expression a desire to be like Him in sovereignty over the stewardship of resources that He entrusts to us. Now, we shouldn't covet, that is, want more than has been entrusted to us. That is, maybe I should say, want more than we deserve. But I think that just wanting to have things that are your own is not in itself wrong. And so a child who wants some toys of her own or his own that's not a desire that in itself is sinful. It's a desire that can be used in selfish and sinful ways, but it's in itself a desire to exercise stewardship. Is that making sense? Okay. I don't think it's wrong then to want your business to be successful, or to want to grow your business or make it profitable. I don't think that should automatically be called greed. And I don't think the desire to own a car or a house is in itself greed. I think greed is wanting more than you deserve or more than it's right. And that's a little bit more complicated question. But wanting to own things in general is not automatically greed, and it shouldn't just be labeled as greed by the secular culture. Well, that's ownership. It's a good thing in itself. But can it be used for sin? Yeah, it can be used in selfish ways. It can be used in ways to harm people or destroy other people, of course. But it isn't wrong in itself. Productivity is producing goods and services from the earth and from our abilities. It's fundamentally good, and it provides many opportunities for glorifying God, but also many temptations to sin. The paper in this Bible came from wood. I mean, how much wood did it take to make that paper? I don't know. Maybe there was some waste involved. Maybe it was a log that big around and that long or something, worth 1 cent or 2 cents, or I don't know how much lumber is worth. But all of a sudden it's made into fine paper, and the paper itself, before it has words on it, has greater value than the wood. So that's producing goods and service. And then we put words on it, people can read it, or just the paper for this outline, so you can follow along with me. All of a sudden it's increase in value, and it's producing goods and services from the earth. No rabbit, no elephant ever said, I think I'll take this tree and make some paper out of it so we can put some words on it. That's a uniquely human activity, to make a product from the earth and make it useful for human beings. And everywhere we look, this building, this microphone, it's producing goods from the earth, making the resources in the earth more valuable. A friend in our church has a precision plastic molding company, and he took Margaret and me on a tour of it one evening. It's in Scottsdale, Arizona. It's not a gigantic building. It's, I suppose, not much bigger than just from here to the front door. And then he showed us these barrels about this big around and this tall, filled with white plastic pellets about half the size of a grape. And just little round white pellets. And you take a handful of them, and that handful might be worth 3 cents, or I don't know how much, just raw plastic. But somebody made it, added some value to the oozing petroleum that came from the earth, so at least it's usable plastic. But then he takes a bunch of those pellets. Let's, for illustration, say he takes 17 cents worth, and he brought us out into the lobby to show us in the display case things that he made. And one thing was kind of two plastic arms like this, and on the top arm there were four little suction cups. I said, "What is that?" He said, "Oh yeah, that's what the doctor holds your heart up with when they do open heart surgery." How much does it cost? $900. So he took 17 cents worth of plastic and made it into something worth $900. Now, if I am having open heart surgery, I want that to be a good product. And I'm happy that the hospital paid $900 for it. So it works. Isn't that amazing? Taking a resource from the earth and making it into something worthwhile. And so every day we just take those things for granted. But if we could transport Adam and Eve sort of in an imaginary time machine here this morning and clothe them properly, they'd kind of blink and look around, and I think they'd be attracted to the sparkling brightness of this water bottle. Say, what's this? And I'd say, well, this is water. Try some. You don't have to go to the stream to get water? No, we just carried around these little plastic bottles. Whoa, where'd you get that? We made it. From what? Well, from resources in the earth. Who was smart enough to do that? Oh, people. You mean God put the resources in the earth to let you make this? And he gave you wisdom that enabled you to do this? And you can carry it any place you want? Say, yep. Oh, praise be to God. Glory be to God. What a wonderful God he is. And how is it that I can see in here, inside this dark cave? What's that? Well, those are lights, electric lights. Well, where'd you get that? Made it from the earth? How'd you do it? God gave us the wisdom. Oh, praise God. Glory be to God. And everything. I mean, you know, want to call Eve? How'd you do that? Resources from the earth and wisdom that God gave us. So all those products from the earth, they would just be amazed at, and they would be so overwhelmed with thanksgiving, their hearts would be ready to burst. Beeping, saying it's busy. Eve must be out shopping someplace. Okay. That's what's involved in Genesis 1:28. And God blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. And subdue it, and have dominion over the fish and the birds, every living thing. Subdue it, the Hebrew word there means make it useful. Bring it into subjection so it's useful for your purposes. And so I think that command assumes that Adam and Eve would not only learn to pick apples and tomatoes and strawberries, but also learn to domesticate animals, ride horses for transportation, learn to form wood into wheels learn to frame wood and later other materials into shelters and houses and then other kinds of buildings, eventually learn to make roads and then airplanes. Well, cars first, and bicycles and airplanes and who knows what else. That is all those products that we've developed from the earth are a result of obeying God's command to subdue the earth. And we should see them as morally good and done in obedience to God, not just morally neutral or sinful. You like that? Now, can people make sinful products? Sure. Can they make illicit drugs or pornography, put pornography on the paper, or use the paper to write letters that destroy people's reputation? Sure, people can make, can they create poisons? Yeah, sure. You can, the good process can be distorted and can be used in sinful ways, but that doesn't mean that the process is wrong in itself. And God has given us an innate desire to imitate him in this process of producing goods from the earth. That is, God is infinitely creative. He created the universe with all its beauty and complexity, and he gives us a desire to create things. whether it's just growing up, you have a hobby, you like to build little models of things, or paint something, or plant a little garden and grow something, or tinker with little kind of Legos. Kids love to build things and be creative. And some people become very good at that and just delight in it, and it's their life calling. Because in doing that, we exercise attributes that show how different we are from animals. Rabbits live in the same kind of homes they lived in for thousands of years, and so do bears and giraffes. But we keep developing things. All of a sudden, air conditioning. All of a sudden, television sets, and more and more things, because we have a desire to invent and create, imitating our Creator. Well, I can't spend too much more time on that, but how many people are involved in either designing, manufacturing, or buying and selling products? Lots of you. So that covers a lot of you. Now, the other category is services, which would be a teacher. You're selling knowledge and skill. A physician, a lawyer. Who else sells services? Landscaper, chiropractor. I'm trying to think of, there are a lot of, give me some other examples. Painter. Yeah, great. Yeah, that's selling us. Selling a little paint, but it's mostly a service. Auto mechanic, selling a few parts, but a lot of skill and labor. So those are ways in which we help each other by producing services, and those demonstrate skill and talent, which some people have more than others and can develop. So those are also good. Okay, so productivity and then employment. I need a volunteer who works for someone else. Anybody. It won't hurt. Okay, what's your name back here in the light colored? Melinda. And what's your job? Okay, Melinda? Melinda sells products that test telecommunication lines, like phone lines. Okay. And you work for a company? Company is called JDSU. Do they pay you? Thank God. They do pay you. Yes. Okay. So when they pay you, are they doing good for you? Yeah. So they do good for you. But do they like it that you work for them? So far? Yeah, okay. So when you go to work each day, are you helping the company? So you're doing good for them. Well, isn't that interesting? You are making them better off, and they are making you better off. How did that happen? Amazing, isn't it? That you do good for it. I'm not just trying to make it something that it isn't. You are doing good for each other, aren't you? Because you say, if I work for them 2 weeks, they'll pay me. And they say, if she works for us 2 weeks, we'll pay her, because we want her work more than that money. And you say, I want that money more than I want my time. So we do both. So that hiring people, it's a way of doing good for each other. And working for people is a way of doing good for each other. Now, doesn't that transform the way you think about work? And then isn't going to work, shouldn't you see it as one way of fulfilling Jesus' command, you shall love your neighbor as yourself? Going to work for someone is doing good for the employer, right? That's an amazing thing. I do think that employer-employee relationships are one way of loving our neighbor as ourselves. And I think if employers and employees think about it that way, it would transform people's attitudes toward the workplace. Now, can it be used in wrongful ways? Could a company cheat Melinda out of her wages and not pay her fairly? Sure. Could she bill for work she didn't do? Sure. I mean, there are ways that can be distorted. Or could she secretly... I shouldn't even use an example. But could an employee be secretly stealing from the company or selling proprietary information to another company or trying to undermine the company and going out and say, you know, there are all sorts of ways you can distort that relationship and abuse it. But in itself, it's a remarkable thing. And again, it shows how God has made human beings to be far greater than anyone in the animal kingdom. So you don't, and no cow says, if you go out and get some more hay for me, I'll yeah, that isn't a good example. But animals don't hire one another to do work, but human beings do. It's a wonderful manifestation of the excellence with which God made us, and shows another aspect of how we're created in the image of God and made to be more like God than anything else in all creation. I think that's so fun. It's amazing. Now, buying and selling. I need a volunteer who doesn't have this book that I wrote called Business for the Glory of God. What's your name? Dave? Now, we're going to set up this experiment, so don't look for a minute. Will you take that $20 bill and hold it for a moment? Okay. Now, would you like this book? You would. How much would you like it? That is. Yeah, and that's what's happening in the market. So you're going into a bookstore. Bookstore right out here, maybe, the church. And you look at it, and it says, $15.99. Oh, man, you say, I'm not sure. So we'll pretend that's $15.99, okay? You stand there and think. Do I want the book more, or do I want this $15.99 more? You say, you look at the table of contents. Ooh, man, what? This is going to transform my way of looking at ownership and productivity and employment. This is worth more than $15.99. But I'll give. So you say, all of a sudden, in your mind, you've made the decision that this book is more valuable to you. You want it more than you want your $15.99. Okay, and I'm sitting there, and I'm saying, I'm as the bookseller, see? I'm saying, I've got way too many of these books. I've already read it. I really want the $15.99 more than I want the book. Is he happy? Am I happy? Is he better off? Am I better off? At least, according to my estimate, I'm better off. According to his estimate, he's better off. So buying and selling is another way to do good for one another. Brings mutual gain. Voluntary transactions bring mutual gain. Okay? I've been going different places and talking about biblical principles related to economic development in poor countries. I've been going with a friend in my church who's a professional economist named Barry Asmus. And we were in Albania in December. And we were leaving Albania, Tirana, the capital, after a week of speaking and seminars and things there, a wonderful time. We were leaving Albania. We checked in at the ticket counter. We got our boarding passes. We were just about to go through the security line, and I realized, oh, I forgot to change that Albanian currency that I have in my wallet. And I had, let's just say, I can't remember, 1,500 lek, L-E-K, that's their unit of currency, which was worth about $15 U.S., but once I entered through the security line, it was worth how much to me? Zero. Can't spend it in the United States. Don't plan to come back to Albania. So I'm in a pickle. So I before I went through security line, there was a guard standing there. I said, "Oh, where's the currency exchange window?" And he said, "Closed today, it's Sunday." But he said, "You might find a private person that would change money for you." Thanks. I've got to get on the plane. But then I look around, and there's a guy with a leather jacket, and he's got a big smile. "You want change money?" "Yes." "How much?" "1,500 lek." "I give you euros." And "I give you euros." And he's really fast because he does this all day long, see. And he gave me a price in euros, and my brain said, "No, wait a minute, that's really a ripoff. I won't take that." Because in a negotiation, the person who wins is the person who knows what he wants before he goes into it. And I kind of figured in advance that I could take a few dollars hit, but not too much. I said, "No, I can't do that. I don't want the euros." "How about dollars? You want dollars?" "How many?" "$12. I'm thinking it's worth 15, 12, good deal. I gave him the 1,500. Like I said, "Okay." And then he counted out 10 and 2 ones. He gave me $12. And I think he was used to all day long, people grumbling at him, saying this wasn't fair, etc. That's a fairly high profit margin. And I said, "I'm happy." And he said, "You happy?" This is December, okay. I said, "You happy?" I said, "Yeah, I happy." I said, "Are you happy?" He said, "Yeah, I happy." "You happy?" "I happy." And so I'm smiling, and then he say, "Merry Christmas, Happy New Year." So I had Barry snap a little picture of me kind of trading the currency with him. I happy, you happy. Voluntary transaction. Everybody's better off. I'm $12 better off than I was a minute ago. And he's 300 lek better off than he was a minute ago. You like that? How does it make you think about the transactions that you negotiate? Or just going to the store? Well, I didn't even do the Bible verses on number 3, hiring people to do work is fundamentally good and provides many opportunities for glorifying God, but also many temptations to sin. Jesus said the laborer deserves his wages. That's kind of a general truth that he uses to support something in Luke 10:7 about the disciples receiving support for their ministry. But the general principle is the laborer deserves his wages. There's an implicit endorsement of employer-employee relationships. Again, contrary to Marxism, because Marxists say if you're making a profit, if Melinda's company is making a profit off her work, they're exploiting her. And I say, no, it's all right to make a profit off your employee's work. And then commercial transactions, Leviticus 25:14, if you make a sale to your neighbor or buy from your neighbor, you shall not wrong one another. But that assumes that it is possible to make a sale without wronging one another. That there are good transactions. And there are other things in Proverbs about moral rightness of conducting yourself in business. Profit, earning a profit is fundamentally good and provides many opportunities for glorifying God, but also many temptations to sin. Oh, what's your name here? Got the book. Dave, incidentally, that's yours for participating. I had one copy left, and I thought, whoever volunteers gets that book this morning. I'll sign it at the break if you want. Profit. Let's say this was a commercial bookstore that you bought it in, and they made, after their employee cost and their overhead and everything, they made $2 on the book. It only cost them, total $13.99, and you paid $15.99 for it. It seems to me that's saying they've added $2 of value to the world. That is, how do I know they've added value? Well, I know the value it started with. It's how much it cost them to purchase it from Crossway Books, pay for the shipping, pay for their utilities and employee costs and insurance and overhead, all that, pay their stuff. They know how much, roughly, instinctively, that it cost them $13.99. So that's how much it was worth when they put it on the shelf, $13.99. But when Mark, Dave, when Dave buys it, he's giving $15.99 for it. Now how much is it worth? $15.99 by the only measure I know how to measure it with, and that's how much he pays for it. Maybe that's not the only, but it's the general measure in society. So all of a sudden, the book that was worth $13.99 is now worth $15.99. Magic. $2 worth of value have been added to the society as a whole. By the bookseller taking the risk to set up a business and have it there available. It's easier if you see this with a bread, with a bakery. A bakery, that Wildflower Bakery near our home that bakes this wonderful, tasty, healthy cranberry bread that Margaret buys for me for $6. And it only costs them, let's say, $4 to make the loaf. Well, but when Margaret buys it for me, we're saying it's worth $6. I mean, I'd pay $7 for it. I might on some days even pay $8. So I'm happy. But when they make $2 profit, all of a sudden its value has gone up $2, and that's a measure of how much value they've added to society. Are you following that? Is that all right? Is that able to understand? So I don't think profit's a bad thing. I think profit is a reward for entrepreneurship, for baking 100 loaves of bread at 2 a.m. before anybody has walked in the door. How do they know? If they bake too many, it'll go stale and they'll lose money. But they take a risk and they get rewarded for that. What's your name? Yeah, Tom. Oh, yeah, that's a good question. You're saying $2 is given to the seller, but wait a minute. How does $2 value get added to the society? Well, does my wife think it's worth $2 more? Yes. She does. So $2 value is added to, well, let's see. No, she, oh, I see. She gets what she paid for it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the seller gets it. But he's part of society. Okay. So there's more wealth, and there's more total wealth in society than there was before. It's created out of thin air. It wasn't there. Yeah, good question. Okay. So, are there temptations to sin? Sure. With all these things. But the parable of the minas in Luke 19:16, Jesus seems to be holding up a morally good example of a person, a steward, whose mina, which was a unit of currency, your mina has made 10 minas more. Well done, good servant. So there was a commendation for increasing the value of one's resources. And Proverbs 31:18, she perceives that her merchandise is profitable. This is the godly, wise woman. And profitable, as far as I can understand, it means what we would call profitable today. It earns value for her. Useful. So I think earning profit is a good thing. So there's kind of a test of people's attitude toward business here. Forbes magazine published a list of the wealthiest people in the world. And they did little bios on with photos on the top 20. And the top one was Bill Gates right now with something like $40 billion in wealth. And we have two choices here. We can look at that and say, I don't like it that one person has $40 billion, that he doesn't deserve it. It's wrong. He's greedy. He's evil, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is unfair. I mean, that's a kind of a envy view. Or we could look at it and say, You know, I'm using some Microsoft products, and they work mostly. And they really help me be productive. In fact, I just used Microsoft Word this morning to print that outline. I'm kind of glad that I have Microsoft Word. It works for me. And so millions of people around the world have said, it works for me really well, and it works better than the alternatives. And so we're going to buy it for more than it cost Bill Gates to produce it. It seems to me that his wealth is saying that he has added $40 billion worth of value to the world. And we should say, wow, am I ever glad for him. Look how much value he's added to the world. Not how much he's stolen. He didn't steal it from me. I voluntarily paid the money. I don't think he's... I mean, if business people start to steal, they go to jail. Ordinarily. I mean, if the system works, and that's what's supposed to happen. And in the long run, it won't profit. But I think he's made his money honestly. So I'm glad for that. I say, wow, this guy's added more value to the world than... I mean, in terms of commercial products, than I guess anybody alive right now. Oh, isn't that nice? I'm glad for that. I'm thankful for him. How do you like... Is that okay to look at it that way? Contrary to kind of the implicit Marxism that's floating around in the university community today and is anti-business and anti-profit and anti... a lot of development and things like that. Anti-ownership. Money is fundamentally good and provides many opportunities for glorifying God, but also many temptations to sin. The love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, but it's not money itself. The silver is mine, the gold is mine, declares the Lord of hosts. If money itself were evil, I suppose God wouldn't have any. But he says the silver is mine and the gold is mine. And so money... It looks like, Mark, that it's going to take me another 10 minutes, but we're just kind of flexing. Okay, and then we'll take question and answer. If Dave, I'm going to have to borrow your book, which is your book now, for a moment for another illustration. I'll give it back to you. You're not going to charge me rent for it, are you? Okay. Assume for a minute there's no money in the world. And I would like to buy some groceries. So I go to the grocery store, I get a basket full of groceries, and I say to the grocer, would you trade these for a book? And he looks at it and he says, business for the glory of God. Well, you know, I guess I could trade. Let me see. I'll give you a dozen eggs, a gallon of milk. That bag full of grapes and the strawberries and for the book. And I say, oh, well, can you throw in this little packet of ham too? Okay, the ham too. So we trade. Got some food. Go home. Next day, we need some more food. I go back and say, hey, more groceries for this? He said, no way. I already have one of those. I don't want any more books. I'm stuck. Because I don't have sort of something to give value that I know everybody else will take. So bartering really limits you. And if we didn't have money, mostly we'd have to grow all of our own food and cut down our own trees to build our own houses with. It would be tough. Be kind of going back to extremely primitive, near, it'd be subsistence living, basically. Couldn't fulfill God's commands to subdue the earth and make all these products without money. Okay? But if I go into the store with money, say, will you take this for the groceries? He says, sure. Because he knows everybody else will take this for whatever he wants to buy. So it's a medium of exchange that everybody will exchange for that everybody in the society has a fixed unit of value, and they know that everybody else in society will exchange it for that same amount of value. So money is a tremendously valuable thing. Again, unique to the human race. Doesn't exist among the animal kingdom. Wonderful gift that God gave us to be able to develop something like this. Makes all of the kind of life we have now possible. And without it, everything would grind to a halt. Yeah, there are other forms of money. There's electronic money now. But societies always develop money of some kind. Because it's a human, because it enables advanced human activities. You like it? Good? It's a good thing. Can it be used for evil? Yeah. And because it is so powerful, that is, it can be used to buy anything. It can be used for wrong things, for bribing people, for hiring someone to kill someone else. And you can covet it because you see it so powerful, so it can attract our hearts away from God, the love of money. But that doesn't mean it's wrong in itself. Money does another thing really well. It provides a standard measure of value. The grocer kind of gives a rough estimate of how much this book is worth. You know, a little basket of groceries. But he's not quite sure, and I'm not quite sure, because we're continually bartering, and you don't measure groceries in books. So I don't really know if that basket of groceries is worth, if we had money, if it would be worth $37 or $42 or $112, because I don't have any unit to compute that with. So I have to say, is it worth 4 books or 5 books or 8 books? And then somebody else says, is it worth 1 oil change or 2 oil changes or fixing 1 flat tire or 2? And it's just hopeless. But all of a sudden, if this is $15.99, okay, it's worth $15.99. That's a value. Now the publisher works really hard at trying to set the value, and if they set this at $100, it sells zero. If they set it at $2, they'd go broke. They'd go out of business. So it's a skill that they develop. But over time, they figure it works, and it prices so much. And so now all of a sudden, I know what this is worth. It's worth what it sells for. And it's in a unit that groceries are measured in, and bread is mailed in, and oil changes are measured in, and doctor's office visits are measured in. It's a measure of value that standardizes everything. Is it fair? Well, it's fair by the only way we know how to determine fair, and that's by society voting millions of times a day by what they buy and don't buy. Thank you, Dave. So money is a wonderful gift from God. It's fundamentally good. Provides many opportunities for glorifying God, but many temptations to sin. Inequality of possessions. Okay. Inequality of possessions is fundamentally good and provides many opportunities for glorifying God. Is this sounding repetitious? Okay, but maybe we'll get the point. For glorifying God, but also many temptations to sin, and some kinds of inequalities are wrong in themselves. Inequality of possessions. The servants in the Luke parable were all given 1 mina each. One made 10 minas with it, the other made 5. And so in this parable of stewardship in terms of rewards in the age to come, one has stewardship and authority over 10 cities, Luke 19:17, and one has authority over 5 cities, Luke 19:17 and Luke 19:19. So even in the age to come, there are differing levels of stewardship, responsibility, management authority that are entrusted to different individuals. So that means it can't be wrong in itself. I think there are differences, degrees of rewards in heaven. So that means in a sinless state there are differences of what we're entrusted with stewardship. So that means that having people have different amounts of property or wealth is not in itself wrong. Now, we are to care for the poor, and 1 John 3:17 talks about caring for our brother in need, and James 1 talks about the rich oppressing the poor. There are sins involved in inequalities, but inequalities are not wrong in themselves. And I think if people are different, which we are, we're different in our interests, in our abilities, in our skills, and in our ambition, and in our desire to work and earn. If people are different, and if the world is fair and just, then people are going to earn different amounts. Even if, by some super sociological experiment, I could, by Monday morning, have everybody in Gaithersburg, or every family or household in Gaithersburg, have exactly the same amount of money, a month later it'll all be different again. As you know, if you give each of your children $5, pretty soon they have different amounts left. Okay? So if society is fair, there's got to be inequalities. And we shouldn't think that those are wrong in themselves. They manifest differing talents and stewardship that God has given us. And having more or less both bring their own challenges for faithfulness to God in heart, attitude, as well as in action. Number 8, competition. Competition is fundamentally good and provides many opportunities for glorifying God, but also many temptations to sin. Paul uses an athletic metaphor several times. I just gave you one there in 1 Corinthians 9, 24-25 about running. And then Ecclesiastes 4:4. I saw that all toil and skill and work comes from a man's envy of his neighbor. I have studied that Hebrew word, and it can mean a wrongful kind of desire, but it also can mean just a desire to do well. And I honestly think it has not a negative connotation here, but just saying toil and skill and work comes from seeing somebody else doing something better than you, and just saying, you know, I can do it better. That's what happens in sports. That's how people get faster at running a mile. And it's what happens in school, isn't it? Good students wouldn't work nearly as hard if there weren't other good students competing with them. Some of you know what I mean. At least for me, I maybe shouldn't say this, but like in junior high and high school, I wanted to win the competition. That is, I wanted to do better than my friends who were doing well. And God just put that in me. He doesn't put that in everybody because He calls them to other kinds of things, or He calls them to emphasize different kinds of things that didn't require doing well in those subjects, and they do well in other subjects. All right. Maybe, I guess that's a good... Well, I should say, the people who end up doing well in math end up being engineers, some of them, and they're the people who design airplanes and bridges, and I'm glad that the people who didn't do well in math, kind of the competition, said, no, you should go do something else, be a professor or something like that, of something else besides mathematics. So competition is a way of, we want to do well, and so it's a way of spurring us on to do better. And it also is a kind of a way of helping us find what we're good at and what we're not good at. Isn't it? We hired a bad painter for our house one day. He was going to paint some rooms in our house. And he was messy, he was sloppy, the lines weren't straight, and he lasted one day. And then we got a better painter who was just excellent. I was helping the better painter to do well and add value to the world. But I was also helping the bad painter find another job, different career. He wasn't suited for that. And And competition does that. Well, we can talk about that. Now, are there ways to distort it? Yeah, it's not wrong to want to try to fix cars a little bit more cheaply than the auto mechanic down the street, and to run run a bargain in your shop. And it's not wrong to try to do a better job than the auto mechanic down the street at fixing somebody's car. But it is wrong to steal his tools. And it is wrong to slander him. And I think it's wrong in your heart to want to destroy his business. Okay? So there's a kind of a fine line between trying to do better and trying to destroy him. Okay, borrowing and lending are fundamentally good and provide many opportunities for glorifying God, but also many temptations to sin. I land at BWI Airport. I go to National Car Rental. I get a car. Whoa, my goodness. I don't own any cars in Baltimore, but I get in one and drive it away. Amazing. And then I went to Minneapolis Thursday night, actually. And I went to National Car Rental. And there I had another car. Even though I don't own any cars in Minneapolis, it was just like I owned one and I could drive it away. Isn't that fun? And one time my neighbor and I rented an aerator for our lawn from a United Rentals. I don't own an aerator, but I can go rent some. So borrowing and lending and then charging something for it is a wonderful human activity. Elephants and rabbits and giraffes and cats and dogs don't do that and pay one another for it. They don't have the developed intellectual ability to do that, but we do. And it manifests some trust. They trust me that I'll bring the car back. It manifests some wisdom in anticipating what kind of car people like and what price to have it at. But it's a wonderful thing. I don't own a bed or a sink or a bathroom or a shower in Gaithersburg, but I come and here's one for me. Because, actually, Sovereign Grace Ministries rents it for me so I can stay in a hotel. And I can go any place in the world and do that because of this borrowing and lending. I borrow the room for a few days, I pay. And I think it's the same way with money. The Bible prohibits lending money at interest, but in the context, those are taking advantage of very poor people who are destitute and taking advantage of their poverty. I don't think it prohibits lending money at interest for people who want to borrow money to do something good with it, like develop a business or own a home or something like that. So Psalm 112:5, it is well with a man who deals generously and lends. And Luke 19:23, why did you not put my money in the bank? My coming I might have collected with interest. I think that's viewed in a positive way in the parable of Jesus. Well, attitudes of heart, we've talked about number 10. Our attitudes have to be trusting God and being faithful to Him and acting with love toward others in all of these activities. Application to world poverty. These verses on the poor have been significantly on my mind in the last few years, and I'm wondering, what can I do to help world poverty? And there are many relief agencies and many people doing good things, but I think one thing that I might do is persuade Christians that business is a good thing. Because because if I give to a charity that's giving food or clothing or some other aid like that to a very poor country, that helps for October of 2009. But then what are you going to do in November of 2009? And you have to give more, But what about somebody who builds a business in a poor country that gives people jobs and adds value to the society? And the economy begins to grow, then people have a long-term solution because they're becoming productive themselves. So if the world community has a positive attitude toward business and toward all these activities, then it seems to me that is a significant help toward world poverty. That is the end mark of this first session, except we'll do some Q&A before we take a break. All right, and we'll just kind of see how coffee-needy people appear. What's your name? Ivan, is it true in the Old Testament that the Jewish people were not allowed to extract interest from their brothers, that is, from fellow Jews? Yes, But when you look at those contexts, and I don't have them right now, there's one in Deuteronomy, and I've even written a little bit on this. It's probably in my book. That the consensus of Old Testament scholars seems to be, and I can see it in the context, seems to me now that the only time people loaned money was when someone was just totally broke and didn't have any seed to plant crops for next year, or couldn't put food on the table, and it was a prohibition against lending to people who were destitute. That they aren't prohibiting lending money to people who just want to buy another farm or something like that. Okay? Yeah. No, I don't think it's wrong for a Christian to loan to a fellow, or to lend money to a fellow Christian and extract interest. Okay, it's Yvonne? Yeah. A quick summary. This was a kind of a controversy early in the history of the church, and up till about the time of the Reformation, loaning money at interest, which they called usury, was prohibited because they thought that was what was being told you in those verses. But John Calvin, who lived in the early to mid 1500s, and John Calvin said, he gives some reasons for this in his commentary on Deuteronomy in those passages. He doesn't see any reason why you can't lend money and charge interest to someone who wants to buy more land to have a bigger farm. Or he gives some other examples. Because you're not taking advantage of someone who's destitute. Okay, and then the Protestant reformers, the Puritans in England, and there's stuff in Richard Baxter, published in 1673, the Christian Directory, where he favors lending at interest for those who just wanted, who aren't poverty-stricken, and borrowing just because they're destitute. So in France, it was illegal to charge interest up until the middle of the 1700s. So, I mean, there was kind of a development in thought. Now, many Muslims today still think it's wrong to lend at interest. And so there are actually credit agencies that cater particularly to Muslims, and they don't charge interest. But when an accountant looks at how they do it, the interest rate is built into the repayment schedule. So they haven't gotten away from it. They're not giving money for free. Okay. Why did I go on talking so long? Because Yvonne's face looks like she's not completely satisfied, but you'll just have to talk to me more later on. This is 32 years of classroom experience, and I'm just saying, yeah, okay. What's your name?
Paul.
Paul.
Could you comment on Acts chapter 4, verses 32 and 34?
Yes.
Yes.
Yep. They had all things in common. No one said anything he had was his own. Doesn't this mean the early church is practicing socialism, or some would say early communism? No, for two reasons. Number one, it wasn't compelled by the government. And in pure economic theory, socialism is where the government owns all means of production. Government owns the factories. Government owns the businesses. And it's compelled by the government. It wasn't compelled by the government. It was voluntary because of a great outpouring of the work of the Holy Spirit people gave to those in need. And second, there was still private property, because immediately after chapter 4, you get to chapter 5, the story of Ananias and Sapphira, and they sold some property, and they said, here, we sold it for X amount, say 500 shekels. Here's the 500 shekels. We're giving the whole amount. And Peter doesn't rebuke them for not giving it all. Acts 5, he rebukes them for lying about it, because they actually sold it for 700 shekels, and they're just saying that they lied. So, but then Peter says in Acts 5:4, Ananias, why has Satan filled your heart, Acts 5:3, filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and keep back part of the proceeds of the land? While it remained unsold, this is Acts 5:4, did it not remain your own? And after it was sold, was it not at your disposal? That is, it's still yours. There's still ownership of property. Okay? And then if you take a concordance and trace the word house, you get the church meeting in house, in this person's house, through Acts, through the epistles, greet so-and-so in the church in their house. So people still owned homes. So it's not early communism. It's not early socialism. It's just voluntary, amazing generosity with an incredible outpouring of the Holy Spirit. Okay? P.S., there's a really good note on that Acts 4 verse in the ESV Study Bible. Which I happen to be the general editor for. And you will find in the various verses of the Bible that talk about business, economic activities in business, in the ESV Study Bible, you will find a positive view of business. I think its balance is biblical. It's being honest to the verses, but it's not trying to heap guilt on people for being in business. Okay. What's your name?
Lisa.
Lisa? Yeah, number six under money. Can I say anything more about 1 Timothy 6:10? The love of money is a root of all kinds of evils. It's through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. What more to say about that? I think it's a constant challenge. We always have to be testing our hearts. Am I loving money too much? Lord, am I trying to serve you and be faithful and earn what is fair for what I've... So we have to do that. As far as you started out, Lisa, talking about care for the poor and giving money to the poor, yeah, I do think having a business that gives to the poor is one way of helping the poor, but I think a better way of helping the poor is starting a business that employs poor people because it gives them jobs. And that means they're supporting themselves for their lives and they don't need anybody to support them anymore. So that's how business, I think, is a solution to world poverty. No. Right. I'm not saying that money is bad. No. I think, in fact, it's a very good thing. Otherwise, I'm bartering. How about over here? What's your name? Okay. What about charging what the market will bear? Well, if I have a water station at the bottom of the Grand Canyon and charge $100 a bottle for water, for one of those little, I think there's something wrong. So there's some extreme situations of great need, which you got to charge more because you got to get the water down there. I understand that. Okay, so that's kind of P.S. But the market in general. Can I just take a minute and talk about the market in general? I think in general, charging what the market will bear is a good idea because it's letting people freely express what value they think your goods are. Now, there are distortions when there are great disparities in information and things like that. But okay, so now here's what happens with the market. The free market is an amazing process. It's an amazing, wonderful, God-given process by which the goods and services that are produced in a society automatically adjust to exactly match the amount of goods and services that people want in the society. All without anybody's control, but simply through the free choices of human beings made in the image of God. So, I have a 7-Eleven store. There's a 7-Eleven store just down the road on Shady Grove Road. And I went in there last night and got a little bottle of milk so I could put it in my cup of tea when I woke up this morning. I did that and a little fruit and nut granola bar. And if I'd wanted to buy a set of ballpoint pens, you know, three or four ballpoint pens, or a quart of oil for my car, I could have done that as well. If I wanted to buy some eggs, I could have done that, and a banana, I could have done that. Any hour of the day or night, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, when I want to buy those things, I can go into a 7-Eleven, I can go into a 7-Eleven any place in the United States, and they'll have it. How did that happen? How did they know what I wanted? I'd never been there before in my life. But they got that bottle of milk right there for me. Yes, thank you. Here's how it happened. If you could hover in a helicopter for a week above that 7-Eleven, 24 hours a day, you would see all day long and all night long, there's a little delivery van, some bringing ballpoint pens, some bringing oil for the car, some bringing bottles of milk and eggs, some bringing granola bars, and then they're gone. And then people coming in day and night, and they're buying just what happens to be there. And it works. And you know, if they have too many bottles of milk or too many eggs, they'll spoil. And if they buy too many quarts of oil, they'll run out of space. They can't. But if they buy too few, I go and say, hey, I'd like milk. Oh, wait a minute. Why don't you have milk here? I'm not coming back to this store anymore. Oh, you say, if you hover in a helicopter for a whole week and you say, it's magic. How could this happen that they have exactly what they want when they don't know who's coming in the store? It's the wonder of the free market. You could say, there must be some gigantic computer someplace in the Pentagon. Telling the 7-Eleven what to buy and what... Can't do it. Oh, there must be some secret government agency that's controlling it all and telling them how many bottles of milk to order. No. No government agency in the world will ever be able to plan what that 7-Eleven should have. And no computer will ever. There's only one person in the world that can do that, and that's the local manager of the 7-Eleven, who knows when the school holidays are, who knows when the sports teams are in town and they need to buy more, who knows when the weather is going to be bad and people aren't going to shop as much, who knows what the holiday seasons are in this area, who knows what the weather patterns are, who just knows the buying habit. And he gets really good at it. He's better than anybody in the universe at knowing how many bottles of milk to buy. So I can have it when I go in there when I've never been in there in my life before. He just does. He sees trends and he predicts. If he does a bad job, he buys too much, the milk spoils, and he goes out of business. Or they get another manager. And if he buys too little, he loses customers and it goes out of business. Or they get another manager. So the market just corrects that. And it's amazing. I have been in communist countries. I remember going through a grocery store in Leningrad that's now St. Petersburg, and watching women lift up one bottle of milk after the other, trying to find, could there possibly be one that wasn't sour and curdled, and just despair on their faces. And seeing empty shelves where there's groceries that people would have wanted, but they weren't supplied because the government can't do that. And then you go in the department store and see row after row after row of the same brown winter coat that nobody's buying because they over-ordered. They're not allowing the free market to operate. Free market's wonderful. It's incredible. And I think God in his wisdom gave us the skills to be able to develop it. And it respects our freedom of choice as human beings and therefore enhances our dignity as image bearers of God. Do you like that? Isn't that amazing? What's your name? Mark. Mike. Mark. How can we help people see these connections so that they see that what they're doing is really part of God's kingdom advancing work? Just by doing what you're doing, just by having these meetings on Saturday and having people come and think about these things. I can't answer that for everybody, but I can say how it happened to me, Mark. I just started thinking, I just sat down and started, what is buying and selling? What's involved in it? And I did have some economics background, so that gave me some more ability to think about it. What is hiring someone? Oh, wait a minute. I'm doing good for them. They're good for me. Oh, wow. Okay, but it was just kind of sitting quietly thinking about what is it in its simplest terms? That was... Okay. So your engineer, what does he do? He's using the mathematical skill that God has given him to help advance the human race. Doing good for mankind. So is the farmer, so is the 7-Eleven manager. Okay? Now, I did not answer your question about whether you should charge what the market will bear. Ordinarily, yes. Because because the $1.69 that or whatever I paid for that bottle of milk, they've set it there because in general they've found that that's what will give them enough money to stay in business, make a profit, and people will still buy it. So it's a trial and error. But the only way to measure what it's worth is to see what people will pay for it. Now, a government committee could say, milk is only worth 25 cents a bottle. Well, that's elitist. It's paternalistic. It's just saying, I know better than you people do what milk is worth. I think it's worth $1.69. That's what I paid for it. Why are you telling me it's worth 25 cents? Doesn't my vote count? So the only system you have is what will the market bear? Now, I'll give you one other example. What happens is, then, if you have a society that has distorted moral values that are out of whack, then you do get some strange, you get some, you think, I wish it wasn't that way, okay? And here's the example. My dad, for years, has been complaining. My dad, who is 92 and getting quite old now, but still alert, he's been complaining about salaries in professional sports. Okay? How can that football player make that much? That's not right. Okay? And I say, Dad, do you watch it on TV? Yep. Well, you're helping to pay him. Because it's the TV advertising that's generating that revenue. If nobody watched TV, you couldn't make a living playing football. Well, you could, but it'd be just the paying admission and stands in without TV. I mean, you wouldn't generate the interest and so. So society, by turning on the television, is voting that they want to spend their time in watching Brett Favre beat the Packers, alas. And that's a free choice. Do I think that too much money goes to professional sports? Yes. But it's the collective value that society has assigned to it. And I don't know another solution except to say, hey, you know, we could be doing, sorry, CJ, we could be not watching quite so much sports. I mean, that's, because I know he's a great sports fan and I like it somewhat. But am I making sense? But the market measures society's values, ordinarily. Better than anything else. Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah. When is it considered gouging? I think when you're taking advantage of great amounts of misinformation or power. Coal mining town where the only place you could get groceries was the company store, and they had exorbitant prices, and you didn't have any opportunity to get out of town. That's gouging. Okay. but people make choices. And otherwise, I don't think there's anything wrong with kind of charging what people value people assign. Okay, let's go over to this side. Green sweatshirt back here. Yeah, good. That's quick. Yeah, ownership versus stewardship. What I'm calling ownership, the Bible calls stewardship under God. I mean, we don't ultimately own anything. We're stewards. The house that my wife and I, quote, own, we're caring for as stewards because God owns it all. And we're stewards of our time and talents as well. Does that help? Good. Thanks. Your name again? I didn't ask. Chung? Charles? Tony. Oh, okay. You don't exercise stewardship unless you own it or rent it or borrow it. But you take care of the cars that you own, not the ones you rent. So ownership provides great... Ownership provides great opportunities for exercising stewardship. That's good. Name?
Hendrick.
Hendrick says, would I argue that farm subsidies that don't that put agricultural producers in less developed countries at a significant disadvantage on the world market, are those immoral or wrong? Is that the detriment to getting people out of poverty? Farm subsidies are taking the wealth of society in general and giving it to a certain group in society, giving some of it to a certain group in society. So they're distorting what the market will bear. They're distorting what the market price is. Now, the problem is that it's hard to differentiate your bushel of wheat from the next guy's bushel of wheat. So agricultural things are commodities, and so the profit margin tends to go towards zero all the time, and there are times of boom and bust, and so agriculture can be a hard business to be in, and so the government, and so government also because of there's some argument that could be made, we don't want to be dependent for our food entirely on other countries, because it puts us kind of at a security risk. What if other countries decide not to give us any food sometime, and then we're held hostage? I don't think that's a great risk, because the world market is free. But in general, I have in general, I think within the society itself, giving subsidies to one group as opposed to what the market will bear shouldn't be done. Okay, and if my strawberries come from Chile instead of California, I don't care. If Chile can grow them cheaper than California, then let California do something else. So there's always something for them to do. So yeah, the other aspect of that is, Mark Hendrick, there's some mechanism that I used to understand and I've forgotten about, how it hinders suppliers in poor countries, because we dump wheat on the world market. And so people can't even grow wheat at a level that enables them to earn a living. And there may be some of that too, which I think there is some of that, and I think that's harmful. So, but the problem in the United States is it's really hard to get rid of farm subsidies, because every state has two senators. And so states that have very few people but lots of farmers still have two senators. And that's good, because it's a division of power overall, but it means that there are lots of very small states in terms of population that don't have a lot of people in them that wield immense power for sustaining farm subsidies. And I don't know the solution to that. Let's take a break.